those searchlights up on the tower. Right now. Move! Move!
I listen to 2ARM, 92.1 FM, in the car and at work, for great tunes and community news.
This is an outing at 2ARM in Armidale with Ron Vicaris, conducted by Bruce Woolley for the Armidale and District Historical Society, Ron's 101st birthday. Hello, my name is Bruce Woolley, and with me in the studio today is Ron Vicaris. Ron is a legend here in Armidale, and indeed much further afield, and a man I'm pleased to call my friend, and indeed an inspiration. Mm-hmm. Ron celebrates his 101st birthday on the 28th of June. He's indomitable. A veteran of the Second World War, a noted actor, playwright, director, teacher, and academic. Even today, he volunteers as writer-in-residence at Boo Books in the Armidale Mall. Ron Vicaris joins me now here at the 2ARM studio. Good morning, Ron.
Good morning, Bruce.
You amaze me.
Get out.
Yeah, how do you keep going? I mean, you still live alone at home. You walk everywhere. You go to Boo Books once a week to talk to people. You come to our coffee club on Friday mornings every week and regale us with your stories. How do you keep it going?
I don't know.
How are you feeling right now as you approach 101?
Oh, I'm getting close to my ending, I should suggest. Yeah.
But you're still...
I'm not complaining about that.
No, but you're still very active.
Well, yes, make the effort.
Yeah.
Being an old hand on the stage, you know, you've got to do something, you get on with it, even if you don't feel like it.
Yeah. Well, we'll get some advice from you about how to live a long and happy life a little later. But first, I want to go back to the 1930s when you were a teenager in Sydney. What do you remember of the mood of Australia at that time? Were we carefree, or were we a bit worried about what was happening overseas?
Well, at that time it was the Depression as well was very rife, and so things were pretty grim in that respect, but we didn't know any different, so it wasn't too bad. And as young fellows, well, we knew about what was happening in Europe. We didn't know that what it would become, although it had already begun with the Spanish Civil War. I remember being indignant. I don't know why I should have been indignant about it. At 11, 11 years of age, I mean, because the Brits wouldn't allow anyone from Britain to volunteer for the Spanish revolutionaries. And I thought, well, what sort of behaviour is that? Anyway, that was much as I knew about the wars in Europe. This is 1936.
Yeah. And yet, at the age of 17 years and 8 months, you joined up to fight in the Second World War for the Navy. What motivated you to enlist?
Well, the fact that the Japanese were on our doorstep by this time. They'd bombed Darwin. So my dad had served in the First World War, and as young fellas growing up in the 30s, grew up with all the veterans of the First World War, so it was all around us, and it was expected that I should say that we'd do the same when the time came, when it was necessary. In our case, of course, we feared the Japanese, because we knew what had happened in Nanking. It wasn't very savoury.
And tell me about those early days after you enlisted. What did they teach you? Where did they teach you? And did you feel that you were prepared for what lay ahead?
Yeah. Yes, well, I went joined up to or signed on. I took the oath in a building in Sydney, in Bridge Street, Sydney. And they gave me a ticket to go to Flinders Naval Depot in Western Port Bay in Victoria. And I like to tell the story about my movements over the next 3 days. On the night of the 1st of March, it would have been probably, I slept in a bed with my brother. We both had slept together since childhood. And the next night I was on a train to Albury, where you had to change trains because Victoria had a different gauge and get in another train. Where we slept, I don't know, on the floor, up in the luggage racks or wherever we could get our heads down, as we used to say. And the next night I'm in Flinders Naval Depot and I'm sleeping in a hammock.
And that's your hammock for the rest of the war, right?
Yeah, that's right. Next 3 years, yes. I slept in a hammock from then on in the Navy.
Tell me about the HMAS Piri. It was a Corvette-class minesweeper. What were conditions like on board?
Well, they're a very small ship, because the HMAS Armidale was a sister ship. And that's one of the reasons. That was sunk in late 42, yeah. Very small ships, and because they were built with a very shallow draft, that has meant out of hull underneath the water.
And that was because you had to have a space between
us and the moored mines that were sweeping.
Right.
So this space was about a foot in the old measurements. And so, but the consequence of that, of course, we had no keel, no stabilising keel that goes down under most ships, and yachts particularly, so we rolled mightily.
And I imagine that led to seasickness aboard.
Yeah, that Nicholas Montserrat, who was on a frigate, on a corvette in the North Sea, he invented the expression, a corvette would roll on wet grass.
The
he's
author
quite
of it.
Right, because when a rowing boat went past us in Cairns Harbour, we'd do a little wobble, a rowing boat wake.
Montserrat was the author of The Cruel Sea.
Yes, yes. And because in my case, or in the consequence of it, most fellows that went, and even seasoned sailors on other ships, when they went on the corvette minesweeper, and we went to sea and it came a few ways, they got seasick. Hardly anyone ever stepped aboard who didn't get seasick. No, and some kind of an immobiliser you for a few days.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there were 80 people on board your boat, I think.
80-odd, yeah.
Yeah. And it was designed for 60.
56 it was built for.
So crowded conditions and people are sick.
And hammock was of little use because you couldn't have nowhere to hang it. So you had to throw it down on the deck and sleep. And I can recall that. Like sardines in a tin, there were half a dozen that was under the wing of the bridge. We threw a big heavy canvas gun cover under us and pulled it over the top of us because we'd wake up sometimes with spray all over it and fish, flying fish, which we'd take down to the galley and they'd cook it up for breakfast.
Perfect.
Flying fish.
Now, you joined the Piri in Townsville, I believe.
That's right,
and
yeah.
Tell us what happened. Where did you go? Where were you deployed from there?
Well, the first voyage were to Milne Bay and Port Moresby, escorting troops and so on. That was about the first 6 months of my time on the Piri. And then we were switched from travelling from Thursday Island to Darwin, again, escorting ships. So that took us to the late 44. And then we were sent minesweeping. At last, we were doing something we were built for.
Were there many mines around?
Well, these were our own mines.
Oh, really?
The Great Barrier Reef was a great barrier against submarines. And so we had this great stretch of the Queensland coast for shelters from the submarines. So what had happened with the Australian mine layers put mines in all the gaps.
Oh, right, yes.
And now they wanted the gaps open because we want to get the shipping going through the troops and for the invasions over in the east. And so we did that job about 5 months. We were sweeping mines. It had an interesting to us because what happens, we could anchor at night. We couldn't sweep at night. So we all, instead of having doing watches, you had the night in bed in a hammock.
Not sleeping very well, I imagine. Now, you were trained as a signalman. What did that involve on board the ship?
Well, that was, yes, it was. It involved five codes of signals. The Morse code, which people are familiar with, which we use by light. And as a by remark, Morse code was a wonderful invention because it was both light and sound. Not many codes had that equivalence anyway. We had to learn the Morse code for the light, Aldous lamp. Then we had to have a semaphore. Different people know semaphore, the two arms going out with the flags on the end. And then there were the flags that went up the mast. People have seen them in videos. There was a whole alphabet and numbers. There were 26 and 30, 40 flags. Every Navy used them, every Marines used them. But they had a different meaning in each code. So the RN had one set of meanings. The US Navy had a different set of meanings for the same flags. And the Merchant Navy had another set of meanings for the Merchant Navy.
I remember
so we had to be familiar with those three codes. So that's about five codes altogether.
Yes, that's a challenge to learn all of that.
Yeah, but it took 5 months to get it through in our heads, and we had to do all that practical training on shore, of course.
So and you walked up, you were marching around as if you were a ship to try and avoid clashing with another ship.
Yeah, that's right.
tell me about that.
Yes, we marched up and down on the lawn at Finn's Naval Depot pretending to be ships at sea. And of course, it was a good training because the yeoman of signals would call out an instruction and you had to imitate us at sea. When you read a signal, you put your flag up at what I call it arm and shoulder level, and then when you knew what that meant, you put your arm flag up right to the yard arm, and then it'd say execute. And when you drop, and then you'd follow the signal. But of course, in the early days, the signal might be to turn starboard 90 degrees, and somebody turned us port, not starboard, we'd bump into each other on them. Better to bump each other on the lawn at Flinders Naval Depot than out at sea.
Were there any close
run
calls?
Into each other.
At sea, were there any close calls?
Well, not with us particularly, but we know that the Wallaroo, for a similar minesweeper, was sunk off the coast of Western Australia through a mistake of a signal.
Now, you talked a little while ago about sailing to Darwin, and I think you saw the aftermath of the Japanese bombing there. Yeah. Can you tell me about that?
Yes, well, the old Neptune, the ammunition ship that was blown up in the February bombing, it was still landed there alongside the wharf, so we had to moor ourselves alongside it, and then walk up to the town, and the main buildings have all been bombed, the post office, the Commonwealth, whatever it was called, the Commissioner's building, and the naval headquarters were all patched up. They're still working, but and the bombing was going on further south, the airstrips further south, so the town itself didn't receive much after the first couple of raids, because the Japanese were coming from Timor, the bombers were coming from Timor, and they go down and bomb the airstrips from which our planes are going bombing them.
Right. So it's the heat of the war at that point. Mm. At one point in your career, you saw the remains of the Japanese mini-sub that snuck into Sydney Harbour.
Yeah.
When was that?
Well, that was before I joined the Navy. I was a ARP warden. This is 1942. Things got a bit... We said something was coming, so we used to have air raid practices. And of course, one of my jobs was to monitor blackouts. And so it was issued with a steel helmet, a gas mask, and what do you call it, an arm label, ARP. And it was my job was to go around and check that people weren't emitting lights. But on that night that the Jap sumps came in, it was actually the 31st of May, 1st of June, 42, we were called on duty, but we didn't know what for. We were not right down near the border. We were inland, suburb eastward. But we didn't find out till the next morning what had happened. Those three Jap subs had come in and sunk the Cuttable, Mr. Chicago, which they were aiming at. So on the Thursday, that was on the weekend, and on the Thursday I was with a mate, we were down at the Botanic Gardens, because I used to work down there, and watched the half of a Jap sub being lifted up out of the harbour and plonked down in the Botanic Gardens.
And that's the one you can see today in the War Memorial
that's
in Canberra.
Yeah. We were astonished, of course. The mate and I looked at it and said, how could two fellas get inside these little midget subs? They had to be small men, but game? Well, correct.
Yes, and you bookended the war, so you saw the beginning and you saw the surrender, the historic surrender of the Japanese to General Douglas MacArthur in Tokyo Bay.
Yeah.
How did that affect you?
There wasn't any great jubilation at the time. I think it was just relief rather than celebration. And I know the fact that affected me most was we had all our lights on in the harbour in Tokyo. We'd been three and a half years in blackouts. But you thought, war must be over. Here we are all lit. I think I did write something about it in my letter.
So, Ron, do you want to read a bit of the letter that you wrote to your parents?
Yeah. Reading from my letter of the time, there was quite a display of aircraft this morning, loads of great B-29s and carrier-borne planes. It certainly was a good show. The rain, which had been drizzling down since we arrived, let up today, and I was able to take a look at the factories in Yokohama and see that though the most of them look undamaged, they are actually gutted and just a shell left standing. As yet we haven't seen any Japs or any of our fellow prisoners of war. We don't seem likely to. We're just anchored among a great pile of ships. But our canteen today donated thousands of smokes to the prisoners who are being evacuated to the hospital ships.
That's wonderful. No. Ron, there was a dramatic moment when you did see the POWs that were released.
That's right.
Tell me about that.
When they came, we got a signal that the British aircraft carrier was coming alongside us, carrying our Australian prisoners of war, taking them back to Australia. And so we waited for them, and alongside came this aircraft carrier, but all we could see were sailors. We couldn't see Australian army blokes at all. Then we realised that they'd come on board in tatters, you know, lap-laps or pair of tattered shorts, no shoes. And so being an RN ship, Royal Navy ship there, and it had sailors' uniforms, so they issued them and all that. So they looked like us. They looked like sailors. Then we realised they were our blokes. And so we sang Waltzing Matilda. I don't know how we started, but it was a tear on both decks, I can tell you, that day.
Yes, I can imagine. You were moved by it.
Fellas hadn't seen an Australian flag for 3 years, and our little flag on the foremast caught their eye, and then Australian voices singing Waltz of Matilda. That was a real treat, I can tell you.
Yes, there's so much more of your life that I want to go through, but let's move on from the war to the peace. Did your wartime experiences influence your attitudes to the Vietnam War? Because you were a strong peace activist, weren't you?
Yeah, but it did. On a couple of counts, I was teaching then in Wagga Wagga in 1960, 67, that's right. And I had a feeling then that something was going on that I wasn't aware of with the... And that was as a price of our being in Vietnam. And I couldn't see any point in our being involved in Vietnam. That was none of our business. We had nothing. And also introduced the marble lottery, as it was called. And this was a kind of conscription. Now, that was anti-Australian in my book. Our First World War diggers have voted against it. The being conscripted way back in 1917. That was not Australian conscripted troops, so I was against it on those grounds. And also on the political grounds, we were only doing it to curry favour with the US. And the US, I felt, was setting up bases in Australia. I had no proof, but I had the feeling of my bones.
And you were
so
right.
Joined the Vietnam Moratorium Movement when I was teaching in Sydney in 1968, and on the grounds of being against both our political involvement and our using conscription. Well, and then I had a personal involvement in that because my son Bruce was coming up for call up at 20, and I thought of I'll not be just out of wind and complain. I've got to do something. And so I wrote to the Defence Department and offered my service. I said, I'll serve in place of Bruce if he's called up. Well, it took me 3 months to get a reply, and they told me that I was too old.
But it was a good try.
Nice. I was prepared to call their bluff, but they didn't do it.
One of the things that impresses me about you at the age of 100 is that you are still very progressive, very alert to what's happening in current affairs and news, and you can debate stuff that's happened just today as well as you can talk about things that happened 50, 60, 70 years ago.
Good.
Do you maintain a strong interest in politics and news?
Yeah, that's right. And being communities, as I was talking about living long, if you make friends and work in the community, that keeps you alive as well as lively as well.
Yeah.
Which reminds me, I've got two bits of paper here about local affairs that I want to discuss with you blokes when we finish the conference.
Let's do that.
Two people here from... in the paper from Armidale.
Okay. Well, we'll do that. But back to your career. After the war, you were an actor, a writer, a poet, a teacher.
Mm.
And it was teaching that brought you to Armidale, wasn't it?
Yes. Yes, well, I was trained as a primary school teacher, and then I went to secondary school teacher, and finally I went to teachers' colleges, training teachers. That was at Wagga Wagga I mentioned earlier. And when I was at my first appointment at high school was at Ballina. And my wife and I decided we'd join the Ballina Players, little play group. And from that moment onwards, for the next 40 years, I became engrossed in the theatre.
And writing generally.
I went to Wagga Teachers College as a lecturer in English and drama. Which was, in those days, drama was only a thought. There was no courses in drama. We had to make them up, as I did when I was eventually appointed to Armidale, where I pursued this, wrote many plays and played in them and wrote them for students. And I had 40 years of writing and playing and teaching.
How many books do you think you've published so far?
About 18 plays, I know. Mm. And there's about two or three novels and I don't know I've published, but I had a couple of thousand verses.
Well, of all of your creative works, which are you most fond of?
This is one I know when I wrote it, because the date on it, 94. Huh? Bruce, my Bruce, he wanted me to read this to you. I called it Butterfly Hearts. Somewhere butterfly hearts are fashioned, not stamped out in solid steel, nor moulded from molten iron, nor fabricated in assembly factories, nor engineered in sterile laboratory, but fashioned by some master craftsman, the amati of heart fashioning. The material long chosen and laid up till the master is ready to craft, to lovingly linger over the delicate details, slowly and tenderly turning, stringing and tuning, till it is reluctantly surrendered, conferred upon some special soul. Of course, no two butterfly hearts come alike from the master's hands. Each has its own tune to play, its select flowers to dip and sip, its wondrous wings to flutter, its nuptial flight to beguile. If you have a butterfly heart, despair not at its vagaries, its fear of capture and crush, but rejoice in its lightness, the sun's caress and the flower's delight. If you meet a butterfly heart, open your nectar to it. Do not clutch, for you will so easily destroy. Accept its gifts of sips and kisses. Be dazzled by its dainty arabesques, for only a few are vouchsafed to bow a tune on its tremulous strings. Butterfly hearts are rare and precious.
Beautiful, Ron. Thank you very much. We're coming to the end of this chat, which has been lovely. I just wanted to mention a couple of other things that you've done. You played the role of the magistrate in Fred Skepsy's groundbreaking Australian film, The Chant of Jimmy's Blacksmith. You've a lovely story to tell, but I think we're running out of time about that. The other thing that I wanted to mention is that a couple of years ago, you, in recognition of your work as a teacher of drama and literature, first at the Armidale Teachers College and later at the College of Advanced Education in Armidale, you were awarded UNE's Top Alumni Award. So congratulations on that. I just wanted to finish with this point. Yours is the epitome of a life well lived. What's your advice to the rest of us who aspire to do the same?
Well, look forward, not look backwards, and have a positive attitude to life. It's going to get better, not lose weight. Cultivate friends, because the friends are worth having. Well, then life is not worth having if you don't have friends.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for your reflections and insights, Ron. And very best wishes for your 101st birthday on the 28th of June.
Thank you.
Broadcast, then podcast. If you missed it or want to hear it again, then visit our webpage, 2arm.net.au/podcast. I listen to 2ARM, 92.1 FM, in the car and at work, for great tunes and community news.